tonight's talk is called The Experience of Self. My approach is going to be a little different than the way Buddha handled it. When the Buddha was asked, you say not self or no self or whatever, but who am I? And the Buddha listed basically five things, the process of our perceiving what we think of as reality, and saying that all of those components of our experience are very temporary and cannot possibly stand alone. And since we're composed of these things that are impermanent and cannot be separate, then neither are we. It's a very slippery concept for most people. So I thought I would take a slightly different approach and just flat out talk about what we think we are. And I've been giving talks about anatta, the not-self idea, for 15 to 20 years now. And in each discussion period, people say, yeah, but, and then I hear where they think their self is, what the place where they experience the sense of self. So I have made a list of where people think they are in the universe. And kind of the number one is memory. We remember what we did yesterday, last week, 10 years ago. And we remember the feelings that went along with that experience. And these contents of our memory have what appears to be continuity. And this implies that there's a cohesive me that's having these memories. This, despite the fact that memory is very plastic. I don't know about you, but my memories have melted down. And every now and then I will reinflate them by talking to a friend or going back and reading my journals, something I really don't like to do because it's always pretty embarrassing. But it's amazing the discrepancy between my current memory and my report of the event just a few days after it happened. Another person's memory could be at the other end of the spectrum from mine. It's the source of many arguments over the years. And, you know, our memory just changes and deteriorates, and then there are new experiences. This happens with me a lot. Something kind of like that happens, and boy, the two of them just merge. And I think it's one event, which has no relationship to anything that ever actually happened. But memory is really tenacious, and our identification with it is. And here's an example. I don't know if you know this about caterpillars and moths, but there's this stage in between. It's called the pupal stage. And during that stage, what used to be a caterpillar, which is kind of like a leggy worm, turns into a case full of goo, which then turns into a butterfly or a moth, which is a winged piece of beauty. worm, goo, butterfly. Very different forms of life. And yet, the memory is so powerful. Some really sadistic scientists ran an experiment where they would expose the moth caterpillar, to a kind of food. Hopefully it wasn't one that was very important in their diet, and give it a shock. And sure enough, that butterfly would avoid that food. This is after the goo thing. That memory managed to persist in the nervous system. So it's understandable that we place so much reliance on memory to carry the sense of self. Number two on the list, and you know, this numbering is arbitrary, but this comes up a lot, and that is self-interest. The tendency of most human beings to take care of number one. And it expresses itself in feelings like pride, fear, willfulness. I'm going to do that because I want to. Lust, anger. In other words, all the forms of clinging, from mild to ferocious. This attitude of self-interest and the clinging that it inspires has this gut feeling of me, me, me. I have a friend who talks about station WR me, which is all me, all the time. It's sort of the background music of his head. This is what I'm talking about. So in here somewhere, I've given it number three, just because it comes before four, is mood. And that goes from I'm happy to I'm despondent. Moods seem like these enduring truths about ourselves at the time, even though they can disappear as quickly as a cloud that's scattered by the wind. Or that poem I read last week, a snowball that's shattered and scattered over the snow. Moods are very, very powerful, but they pass. And actually, this shouldn't be number four, it should be much higher, body. We envision ourselves inside the body, being carried around by it and informed about the world by the body's senses. The body carries out our actions. It does what we want to do. It's one of the eight folds of the path, wise bodily action. We look into mirrors, and voila, there we are. We see ourselves. If I had no body, I'd be nobody. I know this is my body because there's no one else in here. Except, of course, there are millions of other minute organisms. Some of them friendly and some of them not so much. Another place where we look for the sense of self, or where it comes to us, is our social network. Others see me. They do. They look in this direction and they see me. And the way others treat me reflects how myself is perceived by them. It's like a living mirror. I see myself through others' eyes and their behavior toward me. People call me by my name. They tell me about myself. They're constantly reaffirming my existence. And to a large extent, my worth within that network. I take it seriously. And then there are thoughts and emotions. We've covered mood, but thoughts and emotions are more present. I mean, there are a lot of people who are very oblivious of all of that, but the thoughts and the emotions that lead to dukkha have to come from my faults, right? My flaws, my character flaws as a person. And so it's easy to think of myself as the web of tendencies to have these problem-causing thoughts and emotions. If not, then we kind of have to ask, who is suffering? Or whose suffering is this? It's definitely not the bacteria. And then this one comes up a surprising number of times. Of course, I tend to talk about this with Buddhists, so they say awareness. The space into which experience, our perceptions and our mental fabrications, arises. So it's natural to say, who is knowing this, if not myself? Now we're getting to some ones that I really like. Love, number 8. Caring about other beings. The tenderness of metta has a sacred quality that seems to be the wellspring of our souls. It's as if we say, I love, therefore I am. And the last on my list, which is mine, it's not to be really self-interested here, but it's mine, attention and intention. To me, these seem to be the only effective tools I have to be free from suffering. And to practice wise effort by discouraging those mind states that lead to suffering. By that I mean, I can move my attention from a dukkha-causing thought to one that causes delight and love and caring. So who has that power? It seems like me. And also I have the power to encourage these wholesome states and through intention to choose a wise course of action. So when I've seen through every other way of clinging to self, these two things seem to be the last bastion of who I think I am. So that's my compendium of what other people have told me about how they experience self. And let's take about 15 minutes and see what you think about where you experience the sense of self. And then I'm going to come back and talk about why this is all really okay. So here's the answer. Another thing that comes out of my talking about the third characteristic anatta, or not self, or another word for it, very popular in the Mahayana tradition, which includes Zen, and an outgrowth of that is the Tibetan tradition, the term emptiness. You've probably heard that before. They're all pretty much the same thing. Now, when I talk about anatta, people will respond by saying where they experience their selves. But it's also interesting to contemplate the experiences that people have of no me. And I'm sure you've all had one. The most common that I hear about is when we're focused on tasks. My favorite, in my own experience, was whitewater rafting, where I really had to pay close attention to whatever was happening every moment, or I'd send 8 people into the drink. So it doesn't have to be that fast pace. I mean, gardening, too. A lot of people just lose the sense of self when they're absorbed in these different forms of life, or when they're just sitting there watching the breath. Very often, the thoughts about self, the feelings, just fade away. So during concentration, and this can be very pronounced in the state of samadhi, the hindrances fall away. And what are the hindrances? But the ways that we suffer. And what happens is that, for example, I was just talking with someone on this topic, and a fellow mentioned that he had an allergic reaction to some sunscreen, and he had a maddening itch. But during the sitting, when he was able to hold his attention on the breath, it wasn't maddening anymore. And that's because the hindrance of aversion had gone. And so we have the experience, but we don't suffer around it because the sense of self has gone. There's no self there to hate or whatever. And again, related to concentration is the heart-opening activity of helping others. Service is such a wonderful practice for the very reason that it takes our attention outside of our self-interest. We set numero uno aside long enough to help someone else, some other being. And in the process, we can just stop being aware of me. And losing the sense of self can just be delightful. And it doesn't mean that we're actually losing anything. As I said, you probably had one of these experiences of no me or something else that had that same effect where you just weren't sensing any self there. And we don't lose anything because even when we're not concerned with self, you still have a body. Other people recognize you. They'll ask what you want to order in the restaurant or whatever. And the world goes on. And you'll be just fine in it, even without the sense of self. You're just in a much, much more content frame of mind. It's like in samadhi. You don't have the hindrances because it's that sense of self that gives suffering the power to cling. So as long as this mind state lasts, we're free of dukkha, of suffering. There is a beautiful Mahayana scripture that can offer a lot of hope and comfort and encouragement to all the people, which is almost all, who find the idea of not self kind of a challenge. It's called the Heart Sutra. And the first time you read it, it may seem even more perplexing. So I will take you by the hand and walk you through the portion of it that's the most relevant to this talk. The whole thing is. But I particularly want to focus on this quote. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. And by form, it means those things, what we perceive as stable, permanent, concrete, separate things. And then emptiness is that there is no such quality to them. So these two qualities don't differ from each other. Form is emptiness. Emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. So that's the five aggregates, the five parts of experience that Buddha always took apart to say, look, no self. So the commentaries on this sutra are countless. It's a revered Mahayana text. And in my early years of practice in Zen, I heard so many talks on it that my take home is probably just this amalgam of all of them. So I'm just going to say it my way rather than try to go through the commentaries. We are not nouns. Okay? We're not static things. We're verbs, ongoing processes. Time also is not a thing chopped into moments, but a fluid and boundless process that encompasses all phenomena in its constant flow of change. What happens in a beehive on the other side of the continent eventually has an impact on the food on my table and the health of my body. This is what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. We're all connected. We're not just connected because we have these relationships, but because we're all involved in this same process of being. We interbe with all other beings. That's why that word is so popular in Buddhism. It gets around the whole idea of thing. It's a being, it's a process. So emptiness or anatta means that nothing is separate. No thing holds within itself the capacity to exist in isolation from everything else. If you saw the movie The Martian, you know you take a human being off planet Earth, it's not going to survive unless it brought a whole lot of stuff with it that's still there. Anything is empty of any separate identity. That's what emptiness means. When the Heart Sutra says that form doesn't differ from emptiness, it means that what we think of as a thing isn't fundamentally different from what's meant by anatta. The form is emptiness. like any part of a hologram contains the whole hologram. Or any cell of the body contains the blueprint for the whole body in its DNA. What we see as a discrete item is not just fundamentally connected to all other items, but it actually contains them all, particularly sentient items. All phenomena arise in the same awareness that is shared by all sentient beings. So this phrase, form is emptiness, emptiness form, is not just a statement of principle or of dogma, heaven forbid, but it's a roadmap for our practice. If you want to understand emptiness, study form or what you perceive as things. As you look very deeply into your perception of things, you will begin to see their true nature, their essential changingness, the interplay between all things. The outline of their boundaries begin to fade away as they merge with all that's transpiring right before your eyes as you watch. The idea of anatta or emptiness does not say you don't exist or that you don't have a self. It says quite the opposite. You are infinitely more than you imagine. If you wish to see this, observe what you think of as yourself closely. Study the components of your mind. Watch those places where you think yourself resides. It too will lose its margins, and your heart and mind will progressively expand. This expansion can ultimately be infinite, in a joyous and loving merger with everything else that is. It's possible to have passing glimpses of this in an experience that's often called Satori or Kensho. And this is where Buddhism looks the most like a religion, because this vast expansion of the mind does seem quite mystical. But no further explanations are offered. When it's permanent, this state of mind is the last station on the path where we simply get off. When you have reached this point of awareness, you have arrived at the end, the mystery. It will unfold for you all by itself, with no help from anything anyone would say, even if they could. So just keep studying whatever you think of as nouns, including yourself. And may you infinitely enjoy the journey. Thank you.